The idea. I didn't really decide to do it. I just turned my back on the clock and started walking back to my room. I knew that hundreds of others before me must have had such ideas, and how well he had described the pride he felt when he thought he could rouse them, that he might make them move. No, I just want to do it, even if nothing happens, which is exactly how it will go. I just want to go down there alone and do it. It has something to do with Nicky, maybe. I don't know. I don't know. I went into my chamber, and in the incandescent light rising from the sea, I unlocked the violin case and I looked at the Stradivarius violin. Of course I didn't know how to play it, but we are powerful mimics. As Marius said, we have superior concentration and superior skills, and I had seen Nicky do it so often. I tightened the bow now, and rubbed the horsehair with a little piece of resin, as I had seen him do. Only 2 nights ago, I couldn't have borne the idea of touching this thing. Hearing it would have been pure pain. Now I took it out of its case, and I carried it through the house, the way I'd carried it to Nicky through the wings of the Theatre of the Vampires, and not even thinking of vanity, I rushed faster and faster towards the door to the secret stairs. It was as if they were drawing me to them, as if I had no will. Marius didn't matter now. Nothing much mattered, except to be going down the narrow, damp stone steps faster and faster, past the windows full of sea spray and early evening light. In fact, my infatuation was getting so strong, so total, that I stopped suddenly, wondering if it was originating with me. But that was foolishness. Who could have put it in my head? Those who must be kept? Now that was real vanity, and besides, did these creatures know what this strange, delicate little wooden instrument was? It made a sound, did it not, that no one had ever heard in the ancient world, a sound so human and so powerfully affecting that men thought the violin the work of the devil, and accused its finest players of being possessed. I was slightly dizzy, confused. How had I gotten so far down the steps? And didn't I remember that the door was bolted from inside? Give me another 500 years, and I might be able to open that bolt, but not just now. Yet I went on down, these thoughts breaking up and disintegrating as fast as they'd come. I was on fire again, and the thirst was making it worse, though the thirst had nothing to do with it. And when I came round the last turn, I saw the doors to the chapel were open wide. The light of the lamps poured out into the stairwell, and the scent of the flowers and incense was suddenly overwhelming and made a knot in my throat. I drew nearer, holding the violin with both hands to my chest, though why I didn't know, and I saw that the tabernacle doors were open, and there they sat. Someone had brought them more flowers. Someone had laid out the incense in cakes on golden plates. And I stopped just inside the chapel, and I looked at their faces, and they seemed, as before, to look directly at me. White, so white I could not imagine them bronzed, and as hard, it seemed, as the jewels they wore. Snake bracelet around her upper arm, layered necklace on her breast, tiniest lip of flesh from his chest, covering the top of the clean linen shirt he wore. Her face was narrower than his face, her nose just a little longer. His eyes were slightly longer, the folds of flesh defining them a little thicker. Their long black hair was very much the same. I was breathing uneasily. I felt suddenly weak, and let the scent of the flowers and the incense fill my lungs. The light of the lamps danced in 1,000 tiny specks of gold in the murals. I looked down at the violin and tried to remember my idea, and I ran my fingers along the wood and wondered what this thing looked like to them. In a hushed voice I explained what it was, that I wanted them to hear it, that I didn't really know how to play it, but that I was going to try. I wasn't speaking loud enough to hear myself, but surely they could hear it if they chose to listen. And I lifted the violin to my shoulder, braced it under my chin and lifted the bow. I closed my eyes, and I remembered music. Nicky's music, The way that his body had moved with it, and his fingers came down with the pressure of hammers, and he let the message travel to his fingers from his soul. I plunged into it, the music suddenly wailing upwards and rippling down again as my fingers danced. It was a song, all right. I could make a song. The tones were pure and rich as they echoed off the close walls with a resounding volume, creating the wailing, beseeching voice that only the violin can make. I went madly on with it, rocking back and forth, forgetting Nicky, forgetting everything but the feel of my fingers, stabbing at the soundboard, and the realization that I was making this. This was coming out of me, and it plummeted and climbed and overflowed ever louder and louder as I bore down upon it with a frantic sawing of the bow. I was singing with it. I was humming, and then singing loudly, and all the gold of the little room was a blur. And suddenly it seemed my own voice became louder, inexplicably louder, with a pure high note which I knew that I myself could not possibly sing. Yet it was there, this beautiful note, steady and unchanging and growing even louder until it was hurting my ears. I played harder, more frantically, and I heard my own gasps coming, and I knew suddenly that I was not the one making this strange high note. The blood was going to come out of my ears if the note did not stop, and I wasn't making the note. Without stopping the music, without giving in to the pain that was splitting my head, I looked forward, and I saw Akasha had risen, and her eyes were very wide, and her mouth was a perfect O. The sound was coming from her. She was making it, and she was moving off the steps of the tabernacle towards me with her arms outstretched, and the note pierced my eardrums as if it were a blade of steel. I couldn't see. I heard the violin hit the stone floor. I felt my hands on the sides of my head. I screamed and screamed, but the note absorbed my screaming. "Stop it! Stop it!" I was roaring. But all the light was there again, and she was right in front of me, and she was reaching out. "Oh, God! Marius!" I turned and ran towards the doors, and the doors flew shut against me. Knocking my face so hard I fell down on my knees, under the high, shrill continuum of the note I was sobbing. "Marius! Marius! Marius!" And turning to see what was about to happen to me, I saw her foot come down on the violin. It popped and splintered under her heel. But the note she sang was dying. The note was fading away. And I was left in silence, deafness, unable to hear my own screams for Marius, which were going on and on as I scrambled to my feet. Ringing silence, shimmering silence. She was right in front of me, and her black eyebrows came together delicately, barely creasing her white flesh, her eyes full of torment and questioning, and her pale pink lips opened to reveal her fang teeth. "Help me. Help me, Marius, help me," I was stammering, unable to hear myself except in the pure abstraction of intention in my mind. And then her arms enclosed me, and she drew me closer, and I felt the hand, as Marius had described it, cupping my head gently, very gently, and I felt my teeth against her neck. I did not hesitate. I did not think about the limbs that were locked around me, that could crush the life out of me in a second. I felt my fangs break through the skin as if through a glacial crust, and the blood came streaming into my mouth. Oh, yes, yes, oh, yes! I had thrown my arm over her left shoulder. I was clinging to her, my living statue, and it didn't matter that she was harder than marble. That was the way it was supposed to be. It was perfect, my mother, my lover, my powerful one, and the blood was penetrating every pulsing particle of me with the threads of its burning web. But her lips were against my throat. She was kissing me, kissing the artery through which her own blood so violently flowed. Her lips were opening on it, and as I drew open her blood with all my strength, sucking and feeling that gush again and again before it spread itself out into me, I felt the unmistakable sensation of her fangs going into my neck. Out of every zinging vessel my blood was suddenly drawn into her, even as hers was being drawn into me. I saw it, the shimmering circuit, and more divinely I felt it, because nothing else existed but our mouths locked to each other's throats and the relentless pounding path of the blood. There were no dreams. There were no visions. There was just this. This, gorgeous and deafening and heated. And nothing mattered. Absolutely nothing, except that this never stop. The world of all things that had weight and filled space and interrupted the flow of light was gone. And yet some horrid noise intruded. Something ugly, like the sound of stone cracking. Like the sound of stone dragged across the floor. Marius coming. No, Marius, don't come. Go back, don't touch, don't separate us. But it wasn't Marius, this awful sound, this intrusion, this sudden disruption of everything, this thing grabbing hold of my hair and tearing me off her so the blood spurted out of my mouth. It was Enkil, and his powerful hands were clamped on the sides of my head. The blood gushed down my chin. I saw her stricken face. I saw her reach out for him. Her eyes blazed with common anger, her glistening white limbs animate as she grabbed at the hands that held my head. I heard her voice rise out of her, screaming, shrieking, louder than the note she had sung, the blood drooling from the end of her mouth. The sound took sight as well as sound with it. The darkness swirled, broken into millions of tiny specks. My skull was going to crack. He was forcing me down on my knees. He was bent over me. And suddenly I saw his face completely, and it was as impassive as ever, only the stress of the muscles in his arms evincing true life. And even through the obliterating sound of her scream, I knew the door behind me quaked with Marius's pounding, his shouts almost as loud as her cries. The blood was coming out of my ears from her screams. I was moving my lips. The vice of stone clamped to my head suddenly let go. I felt myself hit the floor. I was sprawled out flat, and I felt the cold pressure of his foot on my chest. He would crush my heart in a second, and she, her screams growing ever louder, ever more piercing, was on his back with her arm locked around his neck. I saw her knotted eyebrows, her flying black hair. But it was Marius I heard through the door talking to him, cutting through the white sound of her screams.
"Kill him, Enkil, and I will take her away from you forever, and she will help me do it, I swear."
Sudden silence. Deafness again. The warmth of blood trickling down the sides of my neck. She stepped aside and she looked straight forward, and the doors flew open, smacking the side of the narrow stone passage, and Marius was suddenly standing above me with his hands on Enkil's shoulders, and Enkil seemed unable to move. The foot slid down, bruising my stomach. And then it was gone. And Marius was speaking words I could hear only as thoughts.
"Get out, Lestat. Run."
I struggled to sit up, and I saw him driving them both slowly back towards the tabernacle. And I saw them both staring not forward, but at him, Akasha clutching Enkil's arm. And I saw their faces blank again. But for the first time, the blankness seemed listless, and not the mask of curiosity, but the mask of death.
"Lestat, run!" he said again, without turning.
And I obeyed. 16. I was at the farthest corner of the terrace when Marius finally came into the lighted salon. There was a heat in all my veins still that breathed as if it had its own life. And I could see far beyond the dim, hulking shapes of the islands. I could hear the progress of a ship along a distant coast. But all I kept thinking was that if Enkil came at me again, I could jump over this railing. I could get into the sea and swim. I kept feeling his hands on the sides of my head, his foot on my chest. I stood against the stone railing, shivering. And there was blood all over my hands still from the bruises on my face, which had already completely healed. "I'm sorry. I'm sorry I did it," I said as soon as Marius came out of the salon. "I don't know why I did it. I shouldn't have done it. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, I swear it. I'm sorry, Marius. I'll never, never do anything you tell me not to do again." He stood with his arms folded looking at me. He was glowering.
"Lestat, what did I say last night?" he asked. "You are the damnedest creature!"
"Marius, forgive me. Please forgive me. I didn't think anything would happen. I was sure nothing would happen." He gestured for me to be quiet, for us to go down onto the rocks together, and he slipped over the railing and went first. I came behind him, vaguely delighted with the ease of it, but too dazed still to care about things like that. Her presence was all over me like a fragrance, only she had had no fragrance, except that of the incense and the flowers that must have somehow managed to permeate her hard, white skin. How strangely fragile she had seemed in spite of that hardness. We went down over the slippery boulders until we reached the white beach, and we walked together in silence, looking out over the snow-white froth that leapt against the rocks or streaked towards us on the smooth, hard-packed white sand. The wind roared in my ears, and I felt the sense of solitude this always creates in me, the roaring wind that blots out all other sensations as well as sound. And I was getting calmer and calmer, and more agitated and miserable at the same time. Marius had slipped his arm around me the way Gabrielle used to do it, and I paid no attention to where we were going, quite surprised when I saw we'd come to a small inlet of the water, where a longboat lay at anchor with only a single pair of oars. When we stopped, I said again, "I'm sorry I did it. I swear I am. I didn't believe."
"Don't tell me you regret it," Marius said calmly. "You are not at all sorry that it occurred, and that you were the cause of it, now that you are safe and not crushed like an eggshell on the chapel floor."
"Oh, but that's not the point," I said. I started crying. I took out my handkerchief, grand accoutrement of an 18th-century gentleman, and wiped the blood off my face. I could feel her holding me. Feel her blood, feel his hands. The whole thing commenced to reenact itself. If Marius hadn't come in time. "But what did happen, Marius? What did you see?"
"I wish we could get beyond his hearing," Marius said wearily. "It's madness to speak or think anything that could disturb him any further. I have to let him lapse back."
And now he seemed truly furious, and he turned his back on me. But how could I not think about it? I wished I could open my head and pull the thoughts out of it. They were rocketing through me like her blood. In her body was locked a mind still, an appetite, a blazing spiritual core whose heat had moved through me like liquid lightning, and without question Enkil had a death hold upon her. I loathed him. I wanted to destroy him. And my brain seized upon all sorts of mad notions that somehow he could be destroyed without endangering us as long as she remained. But that made little sense. Hadn't the demons entered first into him? But what if that wasn't so?
"Stop it, young one,"
Marius flashed. I went to crying again. I felt my neck where she had touched it, and licked my lips and tasted her blood again. I looked at the scattered stars above, and even these benign and eternal things seemed menacing and senseless, and I felt a scream swelling dangerously in my throat. The effects of her blood were waning already. The first clear vision was clouded, and my limbs were once again my limbs. They might be stronger, yes, but the magic was dying. The magic had left only something stronger than memory of the circuit of the blood through us both. "Marius, what happened?" I said, shouting over the wind. "Don't be angry with me. Don't turn away from me. I can't."
"Shh, Lestat," he said.
He came back and took me by the arm.
"Don't worry about my anger," he said. "It's unimportant, and it is not directed at you. Give me a little more time to collect myself."
"But did you see what happened between her and me?" He was looking out to sea. The water looked perfectly black, and the foam perfectly white.
"Yes, I saw," he said.
"I took the violin, and I wanted to play it for them. I was thinking, yes, I know, of course, that music would affect them, especially that music, that strange, unnatural-sounding music. You know how a violin...
Yes,
Marius, she gave me... She... And she took...
I know.
And he keeps her there. He keeps her prisoner.
Lestat, I beg you...
He was smiling wearily, sadly. Imprison him, Marius, the way that they did, and let her go.
You dream, my child, he said. You dream!
He turned and he left me, gesturing for me to leave him alone. He went down to the wet beach and let the water lap at him as he walked back and forth. I tried to get calm again. It seemed unreal to me that I had ever been any place but this island, that the world of mortals was out there, that the strange tragedy and menace of those who must be kept was unknown beyond these wet and shining cliffs. Finally Marius made his way back.
"Listen to me," he said. "Straight west is an island that is not under my protection, and there is an old Greek city on the northern tip of it, where the seamen's taverns stay open all night. Go there now, in the boat. Hunt and forget what has happened here. Assess the new powers you might have from her. But try not to think of her or him. Above all, try not to plot against him. Before dawn, come back to the house. It won't be difficult. You'll find a dozen open doors and windows. Do as I say. Now, for me."
I bowed my head. It was the one thing under heaven that could distract me, that could wipe out any noble or enervating thoughts, human blood, and human struggle, and human death. And without protest I made my way out through the shallow water to the boat. In the early hours I looked at my reflection in a fragment of metallic mirror pinned to the wall of a seaman's filthy bedroom in a little inn. I saw myself in my brocade coat and white lace, and my face worn from killing, and the dead man sprawled behind me across the table. He still held the knife with which he tried to cut my throat. And there was the bottle of wine with a drug in it, which I'd kept refusing, with playful protestations, until he'd lost his temper and tried the last resort. His companion lay dead on the bed. I looked at the young, blond-haired rake in the mirror. "Well, if it isn't the vampire Lestat," I said. But all the blood in the world couldn't stop the horror from coming over me when I went to my rest. I couldn't stop thinking of her, wondering if it was her laugh I had heard in my sleep the night before. And I wondered that she had told me nothing in the blood until I closed my eyes, and quite suddenly things came back to me, of course, wonderful things, incoherent as they were magical. She and I were walking down a hallway together, not here, but in a place I knew. I think it was a palace in Germany where Haydn wrote his music, and she spoke casually, as she had a thousand times to me. "But tell me about all this. What do the people believe? What turns the wheels inside of them? What are these marvelous inventions?" She wore a fashionable black hat, with a great white plume on its broad brim, and a white veil tied round the top of it and under her chin. And her face was merely beginning, merely young. When I opened my eyes, I knew Marius was waiting for me. I came out into the chamber and saw him standing by the empty violin case, with his back to the open window over the sea.
"You have to go now, my young one,"
he said sadly.
"I had hoped for more time, but that is impossible. The boat is waiting to take you away."
"Because of what I did," I said miserably. "So I was being cast out."
"He's destroyed the things in the chapel," Marius said, but his voice was asking for calm.
He put his arm around my shoulder and he took my valise in his other hand. We went towards the door.
"I want you to go now because it is the only thing that will quiet him, and I want you to remember not his anger, but everything that I told you, and to be confident that we will meet again as we said."
"But are you afraid of him, Marius?"
"Oh no, Lestat. Don't carry this worry away with you. He has done little things like this before, now and then. He does not know what he does, really. I am convinced of that. He only knows that someone stepped between him and Akasha. Time is all that is required for him to lapse back.
There it was, that phrase again. Lapse back. And she sits as if she never moved, doesn't she? I asked.
I want you away now so that you don't provoke him, Marius said, leading me out of the house and towards the cliffside stairs.
He continued speaking.
Whatever ability we creatures have to move objects mentally, to ignite them, to do any real harm by the power of the mind does not extend very far from the physical spot where we stand. So I want you gone from here tonight and on your way to America, or the sooner to return to me when he is no longer agitated and no longer remembers, and I will have forgotten nothing and will be waiting for you.
I saw the galley in the harbor below when we reached the edge of the cliff. The stairs looked impossible, but they weren't impossible. What was impossible was that I was leaving Marius and this island right now. "You needn't come down with me," I said, taking the valise from him. I was trying not to sound bitter and crestfallen. After all, I had caused this. I would rather not weep in front of others. Leave me here.
"I wish we had had a few more nights together," he said, "for us to consider in quiet what took place. But my love goes with you, and try to remember the things I've told you. When we meet again, we'll have much to say to each other."
He paused. "What is it, Marius?"
"Tell me truthfully," he asked. "Are you sorry that I came for you in Cairo? Sorry that I brought you here?"
"How could I be?" I asked. "I'm only sorry that I'm going. What if I can't find you again, or you can't find me?"
"When the time is right, I'll find you," he said. "And always remember, you have the power to call to me, as you did before. When I hear that call, I can bridge distances to answer that I could never bridge on my own. If the time is right, I will answer. Of that you can be sure."
I nodded. There was too much to say, and I didn't speak a word. We embraced for a long moment, and then I turned and slowly started my descent, knowing he would understand why I didn't look back. 17. I did not know how much I wanted the world, until my ship finally made its way up the murky Bayou Saint-Jean towards the city of New Orleans, and I saw the black ragged line of the swamp against the luminous sky. The fact that none of our kind had ever penetrated this wilderness excited me and humbled me at the same time. Before the sun rose on that first morning, I'd fallen in love with a low and damp country, as I had with the dry heat of Egypt, and as time passed I came to love it more than any spot on the globe. Here the scents were so strong you smelled the raw green of the leaves as well as the pink and yellow blossoms, and the great brown river, surging past the miserable little Place d'Armes with its tiny cathedral, threw into eclipse every other fabled river I'd ever seen. Unnoticed and unchallenged, I explored the ramshackle little colony with its muddy streets and gunnel sidewalks and dirty Spanish soldiers lounging about the calaboose. I lost myself in the dangerous waterfront shacks, full of gambling and brawling flatboatmen and lovely dark-skinned Caribbean women, wandering out again to glimpse the silent flash of lightning, hear the dim roar of the thunder, feel the silky warmth of the summer rain. The low-slung roofs of the little cottages gleamed under the moon. Light skittered on the iron gates of the fine Spanish townhouses. It flickered behind real lace curtains hung inside freshly washed glass doors. I walked among the crude little bungalows that spread out to the ramparts, peeping through windows at gilded furniture and enameled bits of wealth and civilization that in this barbaric place seemed priceless and fastidious and even sad. Now and then, through the mire, there came a vision. A real French gentleman, done up in snow-white wig and fancy frock-coat, his wife in panniers, and a black slave carrying clean slippers for the two high above the flowing mud. I knew that I had come to the most forsaken outpost of the savage garden, and that this was my country, and I would remain in New Orleans if New Orleans could only manage to remain. Whatever I suffered should be lessened in this lawless place. Whatever I craved should give me more pleasure once I had it in my grasp. And there were moments on that first night in this fetid little paradise when I prayed that in spite of all my secret power I was somehow kin to every mortal man. Maybe I was not the exotic outcast that I imagined, but merely the dim magnification of every human soul. Old truths and ancient magic, revolution and invention, all conspire to distract us from the passion that in one way or another defeats us all. And weary, finally, of this complexity, we dream of that long-ago time when we sat upon our mother's knee and each kiss was the perfect consummation of desire. What can we do but reach for the embrace that must now contain both heaven and hell? Our doom, again and again and again.
Epilogue. Interview with the Vampire. 1. And so I came to the end of The Early Education and Adventures of the Vampire Lestat, the tale that I set out to tell. You have the account of old-world magic and mystery which I have chosen, despite all prohibitions and injunctions, to pass on. But my story isn't finished, no matter how reluctant I might be to continue it, and I must consider at least briefly the painful events that led to my decision to go down into the earth in 1929. That was 140 years after I left Marius's island, and I never set eyes upon Marius again. Gabrielle also remained completely lost to me. She'd vanished that night in Cairo, never to be heard from by anyone mortal or immortal that I was ever to know. And when I made my grave in the 20th century, I was alone and weary, and badly wounded in body and soul. I'd lived out my one lifetime, as Marius advised me to do, but I couldn't blame Marius for the way in which I'd lived it, and the hideous mistakes I'd made. Sheer will had shaped my experience more than any other human characteristic, and advice and predictions notwithstanding, I courted tragedy and disaster, as I have always done. Yet I had my rewards. I can't deny that. For almost 70 years I had my fledgling vampires, Louis and Claudia, two of the most splendid immortals who ever walked the earth. And I had them on my own terms. Shortly after reaching the colony, I fell fatally in love with Louis, a young, dark-haired bourgeois planter, graceful of speech and fastidious of manner, who seemed in his cynicism and self-destructiveness the very twin of Nicholas. He had Nicky's grim intensity, his rebelliousness, his tortured capacity to believe and not to believe, and finally to despair. Yet Louis gained a hold over me far more powerful than Nicholas had ever had. Even in his cruelest moments, Louis touched the tenderness in me, seducing me with his staggering dependence, his infatuation with my every gesture and every spoken word. And his naivete conquered me always. His strange bourgeois faith that God was still God even if he turned his back on us, that damnation and salvation established the boundaries of a small and hopeless world. Louis was a sufferer, a thing that loved mortals even more than I did, and I wonder sometimes if I didn't look to Louis to punish me for what had happened to Nicky, if I didn't create Louis to be my conscience and to mete out year in and year out the penance I felt I deserved. But I loved him, plain and simple. And it was out of the desperation to keep him, to bind him closer to me at the most precarious of moments, that I committed the most selfish and impulsive act of my entire life among the living dead. It was the crime that was to be my undoing, the creation with Louis, and for Louis, of Claudia, a stunningly beautiful vampire child. Her body wasn't 6 years old when I took her. And though she would have died if I hadn't done it, just as Louis would have died if I hadn't taken him also. This was a challenge to the gods for which Claudia and I would both pay. But this is the tale that was told by Louis in Interview with the Vampire, which, for all its contradictions and terrible misunderstandings, manages to capture the atmosphere in which Claudia and Louis and I came together and stayed together for 65 years. During that time, we were non-pareils of our species, a silk and velvet-clad trio of deadly hunters, glorifying in our secret and in the swelling city of New Orleans that harbored us in luxury and supplied us endlessly with fresh victims. And though Louis did not know it when he wrote his chronicle, 65 years is a phenomenal time for any bond in our world. As for the lies he told, the mistakes he made, well, I forgive him his excess of imagination, his bitterness, and his vanity, which was, after all, never very great. I never revealed to him half my powers, and with reason, because he shrank in guilt and self-loathing from using even half of his own. Even his unusual beauty and unfailing charm were something of a secret to him. When you read his statement that I made him a vampire because I coveted his plantation house, you can write that off to modesty more easily than stupidity, I suppose. As for his belief that I was a peasant, well, that was understandable. He was, after all, a discriminating and inhibited child of the middle class, aspiring, as all the colonial planters did, to be a genuine aristocrat, though he had never met one. And I came from a long line of feudal lords who licked their fingers and threw the bones over their shoulders to the dogs as they dined. When he says I played with innocent strangers, befriending them and then killing them, how was he to know that I hunted almost exclusively among the gamblers, the thieves and killers, being more faithful to my unspoken vow to kill the evildoer than even I had hoped I would be? The young Frenier, for example, a planter whom Louis romanticizes hopelessly in his text, was in fact a wanton killer, and a cheater at cards on the verge of signing over his family's plantation for debt when I struck him down. The whores I feasted upon in front of Louis once, to spite him, had drugged and robbed many a seaman who was never seen alive again. But little things like this don't really matter. He told the tale as he believed it. And in a real way, Louis was always the sum of his flaws, the most beguilingly human fiend I have ever known. Even Marius could not have imagined such a compassionate and contemplative creature, always the gentleman, even teaching Claudia the proper use of table silver, when she, bless her little black heart, had not the slightest need ever to touch a knife or a fork. His blindness to the motives or the suffering of others was as much a part of his charm as his soft, unkempt black hair or the eternally troubled expression in his green eyes. And why should I bother to tell of the times he came to me in wretched anxiety, begging me never to leave him? Of the times we walked together and talked together, acted Shakespeare together for Claudia's amusement, or went arm in arm to hunt the riverfront taverns, or to waltz with the dark-skinned beauties of the celebrated quadroon balls? Read between the lines. I betrayed him when I created him. That is the significant thing. Just as I betrayed Claudia. And I forgive the nonsense he wrote, because he told the truth about the eerie contentment he and Claudia and I shared, and had no right to share in those long 19th-century decades, when the peacock colours of the ancient regime died out, and the lovely music of Mozart and Haydn gave way to the bombast of Beethoven, which could sound at times too remarkably like the clang of my imaginary hell-spells. I had what I wanted, what I had always wanted. I had them. And I could now and then forget Gabrielle, and forget Nicky, and even forget Marius and the blank staring face of Akasha, or the icy touch of her hand, or the heat of her blood. But I had always wanted many things. What accounted for the duration of the life he described in Interview with the Vampire? Why did we last so long? All during the 19th century, vampires were discovered by the literary writers of Europe, Lord Riven, The creation of Dr. Polidori gave way to Sir Francis Varney in the Penny Dreadfuls, and later came Sheridan Le Fanu's magnificent and sensuous Countess Carmilla Karnstein, and finally the big ape of the vampires, the hirsute Slav Count Dracula, who, though he can turn himself into a bat or dematerialize at will, nevertheless crawls down the wall of his castle in the manner of a lizard, apparently for fun. All of these creations, and many like them, feeding the insatiable appetite for gothic and fantastical tales. We were the essence of that 19th-century conception, aristocratically aloof, unfailingly elegant, and invariably merciless, and cleaving to each other in a land ripe for, but untroubled by, others of our kind. Maybe we had found the perfect moment in history, the perfect balance between the monstrous and the human, the time when that vampiric romance born in my imagination amid the colourful brocades of the ancient regime should find its greatest enhancement in the flowing black cape, the black top hat, and the little girl's luminous curls spilling down from their violet ribbon to the puffed sleeves of her diaphanous silk dress. But what had I done to Claudia? And when would I have to pay for that? How long was she content to be the mystery that bound Louis and me so tightly together, the muse of our moonlit hours, the one object of devotion common to us both? Was it inevitable that she who would never have a woman's form would strike out at the demon father who condemned her to the body of a little china doll? I should have listened to Marius's warning. I should have stopped for one moment to reflect on it as I stood on the edge of that grand and intoxicating experiment, to make a vampire of the least of these. I should have taken a deep breath. But you know, it was like playing the violin for Akasha. I wanted to do it. I wanted to see what would happen, I mean, with a beautiful little girl like that. Oh, Lestat, you deserve everything that ever happened to you. You'd better not die. You might actually go to hell. But why was it that, for purely selfish reasons, I didn't listen to some of the advice given me? Why didn't I learn from any of them? Gabriel, Armand, Marius? But then I never have listened to anyone, really. Somehow or other, I never can. And I cannot say even now that I regret Claudia. That I wish I had never seen her, nor held her, nor whispered secrets to her, nor heard her laughter echoing through the shadowy gas-lighted rooms of that all-too-human townhouse, in which we moved amid the lacquered furniture and the darkening oil paintings and the brass flower-pots, as living beings should. Claudia was my dark child, my love, evil of my evil. Claudia broke my heart. And on a warm, sultry night in the spring of the year 1860, she rose up to settle the score. She enticed me, she trapped me, and she plunged a knife over and over again into my drugged and poisoned body, until almost every drop of the vampiric blood gushed out of me before my wounds had the precious few seconds in which to heal. I don't blame her. It was the sort of thing I might have done myself. And those delirious moments will never be forgotten by me, never consigned to some unexplored compartment of the mind. It was her cunning and her will that laid me low, as surely as the blade that slashed my throat and divided my heart. I will think on those moments every night for as long as I go on, and of the chasm that opened under me, the plunge into mortal death that was nearly mine. Claudia gave me that. But as the blood flowed, taking with it all power to see or hear or move, finally, my thoughts travelled back and back, way beyond the creation of the doomed vampire family in their paradise of wallpaper and lace curtains, to the dimly envisioned groves of mythical lands, where the old Dionysian god of the wood had felt again and again his flesh torn, his blood spilled. If there was not meaning, at least there was the lustre of congruence, the stunning repetition of the same old theme. And the god dies, and the god rises, but this time no one is redeemed. With the blood of Akasha, Marius had said to me, You will survive disasters that would destroy others of our kind. Later, abandoned in the stench and darkness of the swamp, I felt the thirst define my proportions. I felt the thirst propel me. I felt my jaws open in the rank water and my fangs seek the warm-blooded things that could put my feet on the long road back. And 3 nights later, when again I had been beaten, and my children left me once and for all in the blazing inferno of our townhouse, it was the blood of the old ones, Magnus and Marius and Akasha, that sustained me as I crawled away from the flames. But without more of that healing blood, without a fresh infusion, I was left at the mercy of time to heal my wounds. And what Louis could not describe in his story is what happened to me after. How for years I hunted on the edge of the human herd, a hideous and crippled monster who could strike down only the very young or infirm. In constant danger from my victims, I became the very antithesis of the romantic demon, bringing terror rather than rapture, resembling nothing so much as the old revenants of Les Innocents in their filth and rags. The wounds I'd suffered affected my very spirit, my capacity to reason. And what I saw in the mirror every time I dared to look further shriveled my soul. Yet not once in all this time did I call out to Marius. Did I try to reach him over the miles? I could not beg for his healing blood. Better suffer purgatory for a century than Marius's condemnation. Better suffer the worst loneliness, the worst anguish, than discover that he knew everything I'd done and had long ago turned his back on me. As for Gabrielle, who would have forgiven me anything, whose blood was powerful enough at least to hasten my recovery, I did not know even where to look. When I had recovered sufficiently to make the long voyage to Europe, I turned to the only one that I could turn to, Armand. Armand, who lived still on the land I'd given him, in the very tower where I'd been made by Magnus, Armand, who still commanded the thriving coven of the Theatre of the Vampires in the Boulevard du Temple, which still belonged to me. After all, I owed Armand no explanations, and did he not owe something to me? It was a shock to see him when he came to answer the knock on his door. He looked like a young man out of the novels of Dickens, in his sombre and sleekly tailored black frock coat, all the Renaissance curls clipped away. His eternally youthful face was stamped with the innocence of a David Copperfield and the pride of a Steerforth, anything but the true nature of the spirit within. For one moment a brilliant light burned in him as he looked at me. Then he stared slowly at the scars that covered my face and hands, and he said softly and almost compassionately, "Come in, Lestat." He took my hand, and we walked together through the house he had built at the foot of Magnus's tower, a dark and dreary place fit for all the Byronic horrors of this strange age. "You know, the rumor is that you met the end somewhere in Egypt or the Far East," he said quickly, in everyday French, with an animation I'd never seen in him before. He was skilled now at pretending to be a living being. "You went with the old century, and no one has heard of you since." "And Gabrielle?" I demanded immediately, wondering that I had not blurted it out at the door. "No one has ever seen her or heard of her since you left Paris," he said. Once again his eyes moved over me caressingly, and there was thinly veiled excitement in him, a fever that I could feel like the warmth of the nearby fire. I knew he was trying to read my thoughts. "What's happened to you?" he asked. My scars were puzzling him. They were too numerous, too intricate, scars of an attack that should have meant death. I felt a sudden panic that in my confusion I'd reveal everything to him, the things that Marius had long ago forbidden me to tell. But it was the story of Louis and Claudia that came rushing out in stammering and half-truths, sans one salient fact. That Claudia had been only a child. I told briefly of the years in Louisiana, of how they had finally risen against me just as he had predicted my children might. I conceded everything to him, without guile or pride, explaining that it was his blood I needed now, pain and pain and pain to lay it out for him, to feel him considering it, to say, yes, you were right. It isn't the whole story, but in the main you were right. Was it sadness I saw in his face then? Surely it wasn't triumph. Unobtrusively, he watched my trembling hands as I gestured. He waited patiently when I faltered, couldn't find the right words. A small infusion of his blood would hasten my healing, I whispered. A small infusion would clear my mind. I tried not to be lofty or righteous when I reminded him that I had given him this tower, and the gold he'd used to build this house, that I still owned the theater of the vampires, that surely he could do this little thing, this intimate thing for me now. There was an ugly naivete to the words I spoke to him, addled as I was, and weak and thirsting and afraid. The blaze of the fire made me anxious. The light on the dark grain of the woodwork of these stuffy rooms made imagined faces appear and disappear. "I don't want to stay in Paris," I said. "I don't want to trouble you or the coven at the theater. I am asking this small thing. I am asking." It seemed my courage and the words had run out. A long moment passed. "Tell me again about this, Louis," he said. The tears rose to my eyes, disgracefully. I repeated some foolish phrases about Louis's indestructible humanity, his understanding of things that other immortals couldn't grasp. Carelessly I whispered things from the heart. It wasn't Louis who had attacked me. It was the woman, Gloria. I saw something in him quicken. A faint blush came to his cheeks. "They have been seen here in Paris," he said softly. "And she is no woman, this creature. She is a vampire child." I can't remember what followed. Maybe I tried to explain the blunder. Maybe I admitted there was no accounting for what I'd done. Maybe I brought us round again to the purpose of my visit, to what I needed, what I must have. I remember being utterly humiliated as he led me out of the house and into the waiting carriage, as he told me that I must go with him to the theater of the vampires. "You don't understand," I said. "I can't go there. I will not be seen like this by the others. You must stop this carriage. You must do as I ask." "No, you have it backwards," he said in the tenderest voice. We were already in the crowded Paris streets. I couldn't see the city I remembered. This was a nightmare. This metropolis of roaring steam trains and giant concrete boulevards. Never had the smoke and filth of the industrial age seemed so hideous as it was here in the City of Light. I scarcely remember being forced by him out of the carriage and stumbling along the broad pavements as he pushed me towards the theater doors. What was this place, this enormous building? Was this the Boulevard du Temple? And then the descent into that hideous cellar, full of ugly copies of the bloodiest paintings of Goya and Bruegel and Bosch. And finally starvation, as I lay on the floor of a brick-lined cell, unable even to shout curses at him, the darkness full of the vibrations of the passing omnibuses and tramcars, penetrated again and again by the distant screech of iron wheels. Sometime in the dark I discovered a mortal victim there, but the victim was dead. Cold blood, nauseating blood, the worst kind of feeding lying on that clammy corpse, sucking up what was left. And then Armand was there, standing motionless in the shadows, immaculate in his white linen and black wool. He spoke in an undertone about Louis and Claudia, that there would be some kind of trial. Down on his knees he came to sit beside me, forgetting for a moment to be human, the boy gentleman sitting in this filthy, damp place. "You will declare it before the others that she did it," he said. And the others, the new ones, came to the door to look at me one by one. "Get clothing for him," Armand said. His hand was resting on my shoulder. "He must look presentable, our lost lord," he told them. "That was always his way." They laughed when I begged to speak to Eleni, or Felix, or Laurent. They did not know those names. Gabriel, it meant nothing. And where was Marius? How many countries, rivers, mountains lay between us? Could he hear and see these things? High above, in the theatre, a mortal audience, herded like sheep into a corral, thundered on the wooden staircases, the wooden floors. I dreamed of getting away from here, getting back to Louisiana, letting time do its inevitable work. I dreamed of the earth again, its cool depths which I'd known so briefly in Cairo. I dreamed of Louis and Claudia, and that we were together. Claudia had grown miraculously into a beautiful woman, and she said, laughing, "You see, this is what I came to Europe to discover, how to do this." And I feared that I was never to be allowed out of here, that I was to be entombed as those starving ones had been under Les Innocents, that I had made a fatal mistake. I was stuttering and crying and trying to talk to Armand. And then I realized Armand was not even there. If he had come, he had gone as quickly. I was having delusions. And the victim, the warm victim, "Give it to me, I beg you," and Armand saying, "You will say what I have told you to say." It was a mob tribunal of monsters, white-faced demons shouting accusations, Louis pleading desperately, Claudia staring at me mute, and my saying, "Yes, she was the one who did it, yes," and then cursing Armand as he shoved me back into the shadows, his innocent face radiant as ever. "But you have done well, Lestat. You have done well." What had I done? Borne testimony against them that they had broken the old rules? They'd risen against the governed master? What did they know of the old rules? I was screaming for Louis, and then I was drinking blood in the darkness, living blood from another victim, and it wasn't the healing blood. It was just blood. We were in the carriage again, and it was raining. We were riding through the country, and then we went up and up through the old tower to the roof. I had Claudia's bloody yellow dress in my hands. I had seen her in a narrow, wet place where she had been burnt by the sun. "Scatter the ashes," I had said, yet no one moved to do it. The torn, bloody yellow dress lay on the cellar floor. Now I held it in my hands. "They will scatter the ashes, won't they?" I said. "Didn't you want justice?" Armand asked, his black wool cape close around him in the wind, his face dark with the power of the recent kill. What did it have to do with justice? Why did I hold this thing, this little dress? I looked out from Magnus's battlements, and I saw the city had come to get me. It had reached out its long arms to embrace the tower, and the air stank of factory smoke. Armand stood still at the stone railing watching me, and he seemed suddenly as young as Claudia had seemed. "And make sure they have had some lifetime before you make them. And never, never make one as young as Armand." In death she said nothing. She had looked at those around her as if they were giants jabbering in an alien tongue. Armand's eyes were red. "Louis, where is he?" I asked. "They didn't kill him. I saw him. He went out into the rain. They have gone after him," he answered. "He is already destroyed." "Liar, with the face of a choir boy." "Stop them. You have to, if there's still time." He shook his head. "Why can't you stop them? Why did you do it, the trial, all of it? What do you care what they did to me?" "It's finished." Under the roar of the winds came the scream of a steam whistle. Losing the train of thought. Losing it. Not wanting to go back. "Louis, come back." "And you don't mean to help me, do you?" Despair. He leaned forward and his face transformed itself as it had done years and years ago, as if his rage were melting it from within.
You who destroyed all of us. You who took everything. Whatever made you think that I would help you?
He came closer, the face all but collapsed upon itself.
You who put us on the lurid posters in the Boulevard du Temple. You who made us the subject of cheap stories and drawing-room talk. But I didn't.